Cassette 21, Side 2.
And so? So that was the past. There and not there. His whole life. If nothing was real but this moment, plonk instant after plonk instant, an unimaginably thin membrane of becoming between past and future, his life, what then was it? So thin. So without any tangible past or future. A blaze of color. A thread of thought lost in the act of thinking. Reality so tenuous, so barely there. Was there nothing they could hold to? He tried to say some of this. Stammered, failed, gave up.
Well,
Anne said, apparently understanding him. At least we remember that much. I mean, we agree that we went out there. We had ideas. They didn't work out. Something happened that we probably neither understood at the time, so it's no surprise we can't remember it properly now, or that we recall it differently. We have to understand something to remember it.
Is that true?
I think so. It's why two-year-olds can't remember. They feel things like crazy, but they don't remember them because they don't really understand them.
Perhaps.
He wasn't sure that was how memory worked. Early childhood memories were eidetic images, like exposed photographic plates. But if it was true, then he was perhaps all right. For he had definitely understood Hiroko's appearance in the storm, her hand on his wrist, these things of the heart in the violence of the storm. Anne stepped forward and gave him a hug. He turned his face to the side, his ear pressed against her collarbone. She was tall. He felt her body against his, and he hugged her back, hard. "You will remember this forever," he thought. She held him away from her, held him by the arms.
"That's the past," she said. "It doesn't explain what happened between us on Mars, I don't think. It's a different matter."
"Perhaps."
"We haven't agreed, but we had the same terms. The same things were important to us. I remember when you tried to make me feel better in that boulder car in Marineris during the outbreak flood."
"And you, me, when Maya was yelling at me after Frank died."
"Yes,"
she said, thinking back. Such power of recall they had in these amazing hours. That car had been a crucible. They had all metamorphosed in it in their own ways.
"I suppose I did. It wasn't fair. You were just trying to help her. And that look on your face."
They stood there, looking back at the scattering of low structures that was Underhill.
"And here we are,"
Sax said finally.
"Yes, here we are."
Awkward instant. Another awkward instant. This was life with the other. One awkward instant after the next. He would have to get used to it somehow. He stepped back. He reached out and held her hand, squeezed it hard, then let go. She wanted to walk out past Nadia's arcade, she said, into the untouched wilderness west of Underhill. She was experiencing a rush of memory too strong to concentrate on the present. She needed to walk. He understood. Off she went, with a wave. With a wave. And there was Coyote, over there near the salt pyramid so brilliant in the afternoon light. Feeling Mars's gravity for the first time in decades, Sax hopped over to the little man, the only one of the first hundreds men who had been shorter than Sax. His brother in arms. Stumbling here and there through his life, step by step, shocked elsewhere, it was actually quite difficult to focus on Coyote's asymmetrical face, faceted like Deimos. But there it was, most vibrantly there, pulsing, it seemed, with all its past shapes as well. At least Desmond had more or less resembled himself throughout. God knew what Sax looked like to the others, or what he would see if he looked in a mirror. The idea was dizzying. It might even be interesting to test it. Look in a mirror while remembering something from his youth. The view might distort. Desmond, a Trinidadian of Indian descent, now saying something difficult to comprehend, something about rapture of the deeps, unclear if he was referring to the memory drug or to some nautical incident from his youth. Sax wanted so much to tell him that Hiroko was alive, but just as the words were on the tip of his tongue, he stopped himself. Desmond looked so happy at this moment, and he wouldn't believe Sax. So it would only upset him. Knowledge by experience is not always translatable into discursive knowledge, which was a shame, but there it was. Desmond wouldn't believe him because he hadn't felt that hand on his wrist. And why should he, after all? They walked out toward Chernobyl, talking about Arkady and Spencer. "We're getting old," Sax said. Desmond hooted. He still had a most alarming laugh, infectious, however, and Sax laughed, too. "Getting old! Getting old!" The sight of their little Rickover put them into paroxysms, though it was pathetic as well, and brave, and stupid, and clever. Their limbic systems were overloaded, still, Sax noted, jangling with all the emotions at once. All his past was coming clearer and clearer in a kind of simultaneous overlay of sequences, each event with its unique emotional charge now firing all at once, so full, perhaps fuller than the mind, the soul, fuller than it was capable of being. Overflowing, yes, that was the way it felt. Desmond, I'm overflowing. Desmond only laughed harder. His life had exceeded his capacity to feel it all at once. Except, what was this then, this feeling? A limbic hum, the roaring hum of the wind in conifers high in the mountains, lying in a sleeping bag at night in the Rockies with the wind thrumming through the pine needles. Very interesting. Possibly an effect of the drug, which would pass, although he was hoping that there were effects of the drug that would last, and who could say if this aspect might not as well as an integral part of the whole? Thus, if you can remember your past, and it's very long, then you will necessarily feel very full, full of experiences and emotions, perhaps to the point where it might not be easy to feel much more. Wasn't that possible? Or perhaps everything would feel more intensely than was appropriate. Perhaps he had inadvertently turned them all into horribly sentimental people, stricken with grief if they stepped on an ant, weeping with joy at the sight of sunrise, etc. That would be unfortunate. Enough was enough, or more than enough. Enough was as good as a feast. In fact, Sax had always believed that the amplitude of emotional response exhibited in the people around him could be turned down a fair bit with no great loss to humanity. Of course, it wouldn't work to try consciously to damp one's emotions. That was repression, sublimation, with a resulting overpressure elsewhere. Curious how useful Freud's steam engine model of the mind remained. Compression, venting, the entire apparatus. As if the brain had been designed by James Watt. But reductive models were useful. They were at the heart of science. And he had needed to blow off steam for a long time. So he and Desmond walked around Chernobyl, throwing rocks at it, laughing, talking in a halting Russian flow, not so much a conversation as a simultaneous transmission, as they were both absorbed by their own thoughts. Thus, very dislocated talk, but companionable nevertheless, and reassuring to hear someone else sounding so confused. And altogether a great pleasure to feel so close to this man, so different from him in so many ways, and yet now babbling together with him about school, the snowscapes of the southern polar region, the parks in the Aries. And they were so similar, anyway.
We all go through the same things. It's true, it's true.
Curious that this fact didn't affect people's behavior more. Eventually, they wandered back to the trailer park, slowing down as they passed through it, held by ever-thickening cobwebs of past association. It was near sunset. In the barrel vaults, people were milling around, working on dinner. Most had been too distracted to eat during the day, and the drug appeared to be a mild appetite suppressant. But now people were famished. Maya had been cooking a big pot of stew, chopping and peeling potatoes and throwing them in. Borscht? Bouillabaisse? She had had the forethought to start a bread maker in the morning, and now the yeasty smell filled the warm air of the barrel vaults. They congregated in the large double vault at the southwest corner, the room where Sax and Anne had had their famous debate at the beginning of the formal terraforming effort. Hopefully this wouldn't occur to Anne when she came in, except that a videotape of the debate was playing on a small screen in the corner. Oh, well. She would arrive soon after dark in her old way. This constancy was a pleasure to all of them. It made it possible in some sense to say, here we are. The others are away tonight. Otherwise, everything is the same. An ordinary night in Underhill. Talk about work, the various sights, food, the old familiar faces. As if Arkady or John or Tatiana might walk in any second, just as Anne was now, right on time, stomping her feet to warm them, ignoring the others, just as always. But she came and sat beside him, ate her meal, a Provençal stew that Michel used to make, beside him. In her customary silence, still, people stared. Nadia watched them with tears in her eyes. Permanent sentimentality. It could be a problem. Later, under the clatter of dishes and voices, everyone seemingly talking at once, and sometimes it seemed possible also to understand everyone all at once, even while speaking, under that noise, Anne leaned into him and said, "Where are you going after this?" "Well," he said, suddenly nervous again. "Some Da Vinci colleagues invited me to sail, to try out a new boat they've designed for me for my sailing trips. A sailboat on Chrysy Gulf."
"Ah."
Terrible silence, despite all the noise.
"Can I come with you?"
Burning sensation in the skin of the face. Capillary engorgement. Very odd. But he must remember to speak.
"Oh, yes."
And then everyone sitting around, thinking, talking, remembering. Sipping Maya's tea. Maya looked content, taking care of them. Much later, well into the middle of the night, with almost everyone still slumped in a chair or hunched over the heater, Sax decided he would go over to the trailer park where they had spent their first few months, just to see. Nadia was already out there, lying down on one of the mattresses. Sax pulled down another one from the wall. His old mattress. Yes. And then Maya was there, and then all the rest of them, pulling along the reluctant, and one had to say fearful, Desmond, sitting him on a mattress in the middle, gathering around him, some in their old spots, others who had slept in other trailers, filling the empty mattresses, the ones that had been occupied by people now gone. A single trailer now housed them all quite easily, and sometime in the depth of the night, they all lay down and slid down the slow, uneven glide into sleep. All around the room, people falling to sleep in their beds. And that, too, was a memory. Drowsy and warm, This was how it had always felt, to drift off in a bath of one's friends, weary with the day's work, the oh-so-interesting work of building a town and a world. Sleep. Memory. Sleep. Body. Fall thankfully into the moment. They sailed out of the Florentine on a windy, cloudless day. Anne at the rudder and Sax up in the starboard bow of the sleek new catamaran, making sure the anchor cat had secured the anchor, which reeked of anaerobic bottom mud, so much so that Sax got distracted and spent some time hanging over the rail looking at samples of the mud through his wrist pad magnifying lens. A great quantity of dead algae and other bottom organisms. An interesting question whether or not this was typical of the North Sea's bottom, or was restricted for some reason to the Crissy Gulf environs, or to the Florentine, or shallows more generally.
Sax, get back here, Anne called. You're the one who knows how to sail.
So I am. Though in truth the boat's AI would do everything at the most general command. He could say, for instance, go to Rhodos, and there would be nothing more to be done for the rest of the week. But he had grown fond of the feeling of a tiller in his hand, so he abandoned the anchor's muck to another time and made his way to the wide, shallow cockpit suspended between the two narrow hulls.
Da Vinci is about to go under the horizon. Look!
So it is.
The outer points of the crater rim were the only parts of Da Vinci Island still visible over the water, though they weren't more than 20 kilometers away. There was an intimacy to a small globe, and the boat was very fast. It hydroplaned in any wind over 50 kilometers an hour, and the hulls had underwater outrigger keels that extended and set in various dolphin-like shapes, which along with sliding counterbalance weights in the cross-struts kept the windward hull in contact with the water and the leeward hull from driving too far under. So in even moderate winds, like the one striking their unfurled mast sail now, the boat shoved up onto the water and skated over it like an ice boat over ice, moving at a speed just a few percent slower than the wind itself. Looking over the stern, Sax could see that a very small percentage of the hulls were actually in contact with the water. It looked like the rudder and the outrigger keels were the only things that kept them from taking flight. He saw the last bits of Da Vinci Island disappear under a bouncing, serrated horizon no more than 4 kilometers away from them. He glanced at Anne. She was clutching the rail, looking back at the brilliant white V tapestries of their wake. Sax said,
"Have you been at sea before?"
Meaning, entirely out of the sight of land.
"No."
"Ah."
They sailed on north, out into Crissy Gulf. Copernicus Island appeared over the water to their right, then Galileo Island behind it. Then both receded under the blue horizon again. The swells on the horizon were individually distinct, so that the horizon wasn't a straight blue line against the sky, but rather a shifting array of swell tops, one after another in swift succession. The groundswell was coming out of the north, almost directly ahead of them, so that looking to port or starboard, the horizon line was particularly jagged. A wavy line of blue water against the blue sky in a too small circle surrounding the ship, as if the proper Terran distance to the horizon were stubbornly embedded in the brain's optics, so that when they saw things clearly here, they would always appear to stand on a planet too small for them. Certainly there was a look of the most extreme discomfort on Anne's face. She glared at the waves, groundswell after groundswell lifting the bow and then the stern. There was a cross-chop nearly at right angles to the groundswell, pushed by the west wind and ruffling the bigger, broader swells. Wave-tank physics. One could see it all laid out. It reminded Sax of the physics lab on the second story of the northeasternmost building in his high school, where hours had passed like minutes, the flat little wave-tank full of marvels. Here the groundswell originated in the North Sea's perpetual eastward motion around the globe. The swell was greater or smaller, depending on whether local winds reinforced it or interfered with it. The light gravity made for big, broad waves, quickly generated by strong winds. If today's wind got very much stronger, for instance, then the wind chop from the west would quickly grow bigger than the groundswell from the north and obscure it completely. Waves on the North Sea were notorious for their size and mutability, their recombinant surprises, though it was also true that they moved fairly slowly through the water. Big, slow hills like the giant dunes of Vastatas far underneath them, migrating around the planet. Sometimes they could get very big indeed. In the aftermath of the typhoons that blew over the North Sea, waves 70 meters high had been reported. This lively cross-chop seemed enough for Anne, who was looking a bit distressed. Sax couldn't think what to say to her. He doubted that his thoughts on wave mechanics would be appropriate, though it was very interesting, of course, and would be to anyone interested in the physical sciences, as Anne was. But perhaps not now. Now the sheer sensory array of water, wind, sky, it looked like it was enough for her, and perhaps silence was in order. Whitecaps began to roll down the faces of some of the cross-chop waves, and Sax immediately checked into the ship's weather system to see what the wind speed was. The ship had it at 32 kilometers per hour, so this was about the speed at which the crests of waves were first knocked over. A simple matter of surface tension against wind speed, calculable, in fact. Yes, the appropriate equation in fluid dynamics suggested they should start to collapse at a wind speed of 35 kilometers per hour, and here they were. Whitecaps, startlingly white against the water, which was a dark blue, Prussian blue, Sax thought it might be. The sky today was almost sky blue, slightly empurpled at the zenith, and somewhat whitened around the sun, with a metallic sheen between sun and the horizon under it.
"What are you doing?" Anne said, sounding annoyed.
Sax explained, and she listened in stony silence. She didn't know what she might be thinking. That the world was somewhat explicable, he always found that a comfort. But Anne, well, it could be as simple as seasickness. Or something from her past distracting her. Sax had found in the weeks since the experiment at Underhill that he was often distracted by some past incident, rising unbidden from a great bulk of them in his mind, involuntary memory. And for Anne, that might include negative incidents of one kind or another. Michelle had said she had been mistreated as a child. It still seemed to Sax too shocking to believe. On Earth, men had abused women. On Mars, never. Was that true? Sax didn't know for sure, but he felt it was true. This was what it meant to live in a just and rational society. This was one of the main reasons it was a good thing, a value. Possibly Anne would know more about the reality of the situation these days, but he didn't feel comfortable asking her. It was clearly contraindicated.
"You're awfully quiet," she said.
"Enjoying the view," he said quickly. Perhaps he had better talk about wave mechanics after all. He explained the groundswell, the cross-chop, the negative and positive interference patterns that could result. But then he said, "Did you remember much about Earth during the Underhill experiment?"
"No."
"Ah." This was probably some kind of repression, and exactly the opposite of the psychotherapeutic method that Michelle would probably have recommended. But they were not steam engines, and some things were no doubt better forgotten. He would have to work on once again forgetting John's death, for instance. Also on remembering better those parts of his life when he had been most social, as during the years of work for Biotique in Burroughs. So that across the cockpit from him sat Counter Anne, or that third woman she had mentioned, while he was, at least in part, Stephen Lindholm. Strangers, despite that startling encounter at Underhill. Or because of it. "Hello. Nice to meet you." Once they got out from among the fjords and islands at the bottom of Crissy Gulf, Sax turned the tiller and the boat swooped northeast, rushing across the wind and the whitecaps. Then the wind was behind them, and with a following wind, the mastsail bloomed into its own splayed wing version of a spinnaker, and the hulls surfed on the meshy crests of the waves before losing to their superior speed. The eastern shore of the Crissy Gulf appeared before them. It was less spectacular than the western shore, but in many ways prettier. Buildings, towers, bridges. It was a well-populated coast, as were most of them these days. Coming off Olympus, all the towns must be a bit of a shock. After they passed the broad mouth of the Ares Fjord, Suchow Point emerged over the horizon, and then beyond it the Oxia Islands, one by one. Before the water's arrival, these had been the Oxia Collies, an array of round hills that stood at just the height to become an archipelago. Sack sailed into the narrow waterways between these islands, each a low round brown hump standing 40 or 50 meters out of the sea. By far, the larger percentage of them were uninhabited, except perhaps by goats, but on the largest ones, especially kidney-shaped ones with bays, the stones covering the hills had been gathered up into walls which split the slopes into fields and pastures. These islands were irrigated, green with orchards laden with fruit, or pastures dotted with white sheep or miniature cows. The ship's maritime chart named these islands Kipini, Wahoo, Wabash, Naukam, Libertad. And reading the map, Anne snorted. These are the names of the craters out in the middle of the gulf, underwater. Ah. Still, they were pretty islands. The fishing villages on the bays were whitewashed with blue shutters and doors, the Aegean model again. Indeed, on one high point bluff there stood a little Doric temple, square and proud. The boats down below in the bays were small sloops or simply rowboats and dories. As they sailed past, Sachs pointed out a hilltop windmill here, a pasture of llamas there. It seems a nice life. They talked about the natives then, easily and without hidden tension. About Zoe. About the ferals and their strange hunter-gatherer, city-shopper lifestyle. About the ag nomads, moving from crop to crop like migrant laborers who owned the farms. About the cross-fertilization of all these styles. About the new Terran settlements elbowing into the landscape. About the increasing number of harbor towns. Off in the middle of the bay, they spotted one of the new big townships, a floating island of a sea craft with a population in the thousands. It was too big to enter the Oxia Archipelago, and looked to be headed across the gulf to Nilocharis, or down to the southern fjords. As the land all over Mars was becoming more crowded, and the possibility of settling on it more and more restricted by the courts, more and more people were moving on to the North Sea, making townships like these their permanent home.
Let's go visit it, Anne said. Can we?
I don't see why not, Sachs said, surprised at the request. We can certainly catch it.
He brought the catamaran about and tacked south and west toward the township, pushing the cat as much as he could to impress the seafarers. In less than an hour they had reached its broad side, a rounded scarp about 2 kilometers long and 50 meters tall. A dock just above the waterline had a section against the township that would rise as an open elevator, and when they had stepped across from the cat to the dock and tied their boat on, they got into this railed-off section and were lifted up to the deck of the township. The deck was almost as broad as it was long, its central area a farm with many small trees scattered on it, so it was hard to see the other side. But it was clear from what they could see that the circumference of the deck was a kind of rectangular street or arcade, with buildings on both sides that were 2 to 4 stories high, the outer buildings topped by masts and windmills, the inner ones opening into broad breaks where parks and plazas led inward to the crops and groves of the farm and a big freshwater pond. A floating town, somewhat like a walled city in Renaissance Tuscany in appearance, except that everything was extraordinarily neat and orderly, ship-shape, as one might say. A small group of the ship's citizens greeted them on the plaza overlooking the dock, and when they found out who their visitors were, they were thrilled. They insisted the travelers stay for a meal, and a few of them guided them on a walk around the perimeter of the ship. Or for as far as you care to go. It's a good, fair walk. This was a small township, they were told. Population 5,000. Since its launch, it had been almost entirely self-sufficient. We grow most of our food, and fish for the rest. There are arguments now with other townships about overfishing certain species. We're doing perennial polyculture, growing new strains of corn, sunflower, soybean, sand plum, and so on, all intermixed and harvested by robot, because harvesting is backbreaking work. We've finally got the technology to go home to gathering. That's what it comes down to. There are a lot of onboard cottage industries. We've got wineries. See the vineyards out there? And there are vintners and brandy distillers. That we do by hand. Also special function semiconductors and a famous bike shop. Most of the time we sail around the North Sea. There are some really violent storms sometimes, but we're so big that we ride them out pretty easily. Most of us have lived here for all 10 years the ship has existed. It's a great life. The ship is all you need, although it's great fun to make landfall from time to time. We come down to Nalocaris every LS0 for the spring festival. We sell what we've made and resupply and party all night long, then back out to sea. We don't use anything but wind and sunlight and some fish. The environmental courts like us. They agree we're minimum impact. The population of the North Seas area might be even higher now than if it had stayed land. There are hundreds of townships now. Thousands. And the harbor towns with the shipyards and the seaports we visit to do business, they're doing very well indeed. Anne said,
And you think this is one way we can take on some of Earth's surplus population?
Yes, we do. One of the best ways. It's a big ocean. It could take a lot more ships like this.
As long as they didn't rely too much on fishing.
As they walked on, Sack said to Anne, That's another reason that it just isn't worth it to force a crisis over the immigration issue.
Anne didn't reply. She was staring down at the sunburnished water, then up at one of the couple dozen masts, each with its single schooner sail. The town looked like a tabular iceberg with its surface entirely claimed by Earth, a floating island.
So many different kinds of nomads, Sachs commented. It seems that very few of the natives feel impelled to settle in a single place.
Unlike us.
Point taken. But I wonder if this tendency means they are inclined to a certain redness, if you know what I mean.
I do not, Sachs tried to explain.
It seems to me that nomads in general tend to make use of the land as they find it. They move around with the seasons and live off what they find growing at that time. And seafaring nomads, of course, even more so, given that the sea is impervious to most human attempts to change it.
Except for the people trying to regulate sea level or salt content, have you heard about them?
Yes, but they're not going to have much luck with that, I would guess. The mechanics of saltification are still very poorly understood.
If they succeed, it will kill a lot of freshwater species.
True, but the saltwater species will be happy.
They walked across the middle of the township toward the plaza over the dock, passing between long rows of grapevines pruned to the shape of waist-high tees, the intermingled horizontal vines heavy with grape clusters of dusty indigo and bracken and clear viridine. Beyond the vineyards, the ground was covered with a mix of plants, like a kind of prairie, with narrow foot trails cutting through it. At a restaurant fronting the plaza, they were treated to a meal of pasta and shrimp. The conversation ranged everywhere. But then someone came rushing out of the kitchen, pointing at his wrist. News had just come in of trouble on the space elevator. The UN troops who had been sharing the customs duties on New Clark had taken over the whole station and sent all the Martian police down, charging them with corruption and declaring that the UN would administer the upper end of the elevator by itself from now on. The UN Security Council was now saying that their local officers had overstepped their instructions
But this backpedaling didn't include an invitation to the Martians to come back up the cable again, so it looked like a smokescreen to Sax.
"Oh, my," he said. "Maya will be very angry, I fear."
Anne rolled her eyes. "That isn't really the most important ramification, if you ask me." She looked shocked, and for the first time since Sax had found her in Olympus Caldera, fully engaged in the current situation, drawn out of her distance. It was fairly shocking, now that he thought of it. Even these seafarers were visibly shaken, though before they, like Anne, had seemed distanced from whatever circumstances obtained on land. He could see the news tearing through the restaurant's conversations and throwing them all into the same space. Upheaval, crisis, the threat of war. Voices were incredulous. Faces were angry. The people at their table were also watching Sax and Anne, curious as to their reaction.
"You'll have to do something about this," one of their guides noted.
"Why us?" Anne replied tartly. "It's you who will have to do something about it, if you ask me. You're the ones responsible now. We're just a couple of old Issei."
Their dinner companions looked startled, uncertain how to take her.
One laughed. The host who had spoken shook his head.
"That's not true. But you're right. We will be watching and talking with the other townships about how to respond. We'll do our part. I was just saying that people will be looking to you, to both of you, to see what you do. That isn't so true for us."
Anne was silenced by this. Sax returned to his meal, thinking furiously. He found he wanted to talk to Maya. The evening continued, the sun fell. The dinner limped on as they all tried to return to some sense of normality. Sax repressed a little smile. There might be an interplanetary crisis, and there might not, but meanwhile dinner had to be gotten through in style. And these seafarers were not the kind of people who looked inclined to worry about the solar system at large. So the mood rallied, and they partied over their dessert, still very pleased to have Claiborne and Russell visiting them. And then in the last light, the two of them made their excuses and were escorted down to sea level and their boat. The waves on Crisi Gulf were a lot larger than they had seemed from up above. Sax and Anne sailed off in silence, wrapped in their own thoughts. Sax looked up at the township, thinking about what they had seen that day. It looked like a good life. But something about... He chased the thought, and then at the end of the rapid steeplechase, he caught it, and still held it all. No blankouts these days, which was a great satisfaction, although the content of this particular train of thought was quite melancholy. Should he even try to share it with Anne? Was it possible to say it? He said, "Sometimes I regret, when I see those seafarers and the lives they lead, it seems ironic that we stand on the brink of a kind of golden age." There, he had said it, and he felt foolish. "Which will only come to pass when our generation has died. We've worked for it all our lives, and then we have to die before it will come."
"Like Moses outside Israel."
"Yes. Did he not get to go in?"
Sax shook his head.
"These old stories.
Such a throwing together, like science at its heart, like the flashes of insight one got into an experiment when everything about it clarified and one understood something."
"Well, I can imagine how he felt. It's frustrating. I would rather see what happens then. Sometimes I get so curious about the history we'll never know, the future after our death, and all the rest of it. Do you know what I mean?"
Anne was looking at him closely. Finally, she said, "Everything dies someday. Better to die thinking that you're going to miss a golden age than to go out thinking that you had taken down your children's chances with you. That you had left your descendants with all kinds of toxic long-term debts, Now that would be depressing. As it is, we only have to feel bad for ourselves.
True.
And this was Anne Claiborne talking. Sax felt that his face was glowing, that capillary action could be quite a pleasant sensation. They returned to the Oxia Archipelago and sailed through the islands, talking about them. It was possible to talk. They ate in the cockpit and slept each in their own hull cabin, port and starboard. One fresh morning, with the wind wafting offshore cool and fragrant, Sax said, "I still wonder about the possibility of some kind of browns." Anne glanced at him. "And where's the red in it?" "Well, in the desire to hold things steady, to keep a lot of the land untouched. The areophany."
"That's always been green. It sounds like green with just a little touch of red, if you ask me. The khakis."
"Yes, I suppose. That would be Arishka and the Free Mars Coalition, right? But also burnt umbers, siennas, madder alizarins, Indian reds."
"I don't think there are any Indian reds," and she laughed darkly.
Indeed, she laughed fairly often, though the humor expressed seemed often quite mordant. One evening he was in his cabin, and she up near the bow of her hull. She took the port, he the starboard, and he heard her laugh out loud, and coming up and looking around, he thought it must have been caused by the sight of Pseudo-Phobos, most people just called it Phobos, rising again swiftly out of the west in its old manner. The moons of Mars, sailing through the night again, little gray potatoes of no great distinction, but there they were. As was that dark laugh at the sight of them.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 21 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 22.